the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver. Brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
And come and be with us, and we really appreciate it. My name is Kent Hull. I'm the Assistant Administrator for the Bureau of Global Health at USAID. And this session on behavior change within the scope of HIV prevention is, in fact, exceptionally important. Several times in the last couple days, we've heard either Bill Gates or former President Clinton talking about the concerns, and Peter Piot the first night as well, about what would happen if our successes in getting more people on treatment, et cetera, continue to be overwhelmed by the number of new infections, which to this point has been the challenge that we have faced. And it's not just the question of the global burden of coming up with enough resources to put everybody on treatment who will need it in the coming years. We had a press conference yesterday with UNICEF, which talked about the startling predictions on the number of orphans. And it's not just a question of finding the money to work with the orphans, it's just much better if you have a situation where there are less orphans to work with. Makes what we're trying to do this morning all the more important. And I want to just make a couple of quick comments before I turn it over to our moderator. And note that the United States Agency for International Development is one of the U.S. government agencies, the main one that spends PEPFAR money on a whole series of things, a fairly small percentage of which has anything to do with sexual transmission, but it's a significant and important part of our portfolio. The comprehensive strategy of ABC, or abstain or delay sexual debut, be faithful, and the consistent and correct use of condoms is the backbone of that. But of course, the prevention activities include blood safety, has to do with pregnant women. It also has to do with dealing in certain countries in the world, like in Russia or Central Asia or Vietnam, with the spread of the disease through needles and drugs. The ABC part of the prevention strategy is good public health based on evidence and based on respect for local culture. We all should be reminded of the fact that it initially was an African solution developed in Africa and not in the United States. We simply picked it up as making good sense and being supported by the evidence. And I do want to say something about some new evidence that has come out in the last few months from Zimbabwe and Kenya, which offers powerful confirmation that the evidence suggests that that kind of comprehensive approach can make a difference. And here I begin with some comments from the Minister of Health in Kenya, who gave a report recently that estimates that HIV prevalence has dropped markedly in recent years, and the findings indicated the following. It showed that there was increased male faithfulness, as measured by a 50% reduction in the percentage of men who reported more than one sexual partner in the preceding year. It reported that there was a delayed sexual debut among young women, with the median age of sexual debut rising from 16.7 to 17.8. It reported that among teenage boys and girls, there was a high level of primary abstinence and even secondary abstinence. Then there was the report from Science Magazine about what's going on in Zimbabwe. The report came out, or at least the Science Magazine report, came out in February of this year, and it showed that among men aged 17 to 29 in eastern Zimbabwe, the HIV prevalence rate had fallen by 23% between 1998 and 2003. And even more impressively, the prevalence among women aged 15 to 24 dropped by a remarkable 49%. And the findings showed that this was a result of abstinence, or in this case, delay of sexual debut. Among men aged 17 to 19, the percentage who had begun sexual activity dropped from 45% to 27%, and among women aged 15 to 17, it dropped from 21% to 9%. And if anybody doubts that it is possible to delay sexual debut, these statistics provide hard empirical evidence to the contrary. With respect to the issue of whether it's possible to have major improvement on the being faithful category, the Zimbabwe information shows that among those men who were sexually experienced, the proportion who reported in with a last sexual contact with a casual partner, those who were using condoms, increased pretty significantly among women, I should say. Among men, the report was not as encouraging, which obviously tells us a place that we have to do some work, because you could have a faithful woman in a marriage situation even, and she's going to be at risk if the male behavior in this case does not change. But a lot of this is encouraging. It tells us that the comprehensive approach is the right way to go. And now just a word about our facilitator. Dr. Barbara Zalduondo has a PhD in biological anthropology from Harvard University and a Master of Science in Behavioral Sciences from the Harvard School of Public Health. Between 1994 and 2000, we got to know her at USAID because she was senior technical advisor for us. And we have fond memories of her because it is to her that we associate some of our important early interventions. And I want to be more specific here. She was an early advocate for scaling up VCT for female condom distribution. She was a adherent and a strong supporter of microbicides and other innovative women and youth-friendly AIDS responses. I want to skip to what she's doing now because it's an exceptionally important position she holds at UNAIDS. She is the Associate Director for Epidemic Monitoring and Prevention in the UNAIDS Policy, Evidence, and Partnerships Department. And she leads the department's prevention, care, and impact team, and also the team that deals with epidemic impact monitoring. So she's exceptionally qualified, has been an HIV specialist for 20 years. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Barbara.
Thank you, Ken. And thank you all for either interrupting your long morning if you've come in from far away and have a severe case of jet lag, or for interrupting your sleep if you've if you're from this hemisphere and are getting up early. We're delighted to see you, and I want to thank our colleagues at USAID for convening this interesting and important session about refining the prevention paradigm, because if we had it straight, if we had everything right, we wouldn't be seeing the 4 million new infections as recently as 2005 that we are seeing. So it's about learning from experience, doing what we do better, and presumably more of it and better tailored to the local circumstances. We have a very distinguished panel this morning. I'm going to tell you a little bit about each of the members of the panel, and then when we start the presentations, I won't interrupt for biographical data in between our presenters. Our first speaker will be Dr. David Wilson, who is Senior Monitoring and Evaluation Specialist in the Global HIV/AIDS Program of the World Bank. David and I have known each other for a long time as the behavioral researchers in working on HIV since the early 90s, I guess. And David has worked in over 50 countries in not only in sub-Saharan Africa, where he's from Zimbabwe, but also in Asia, Europe, and the Pacific. And he's published very extensively. His interests lie in the use of epidemiological data to design effective programs and to develop effective interventions, particularly for vulnerable populations. Our second speaker will be Dr. Suzanne Leclerc-Madlala. Suzanne is a medical anthropologist and head of the Department of Anthropology at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa. She also has a long history of research in African indigenous medicine, gender, and sexuality, and in the development of culturally informed and sustainable HIV prevention programs. Over the past decade, she's focused in South Africa on sexuality and youth and intervention evaluation and development. And she is widely published on the sociocultural aspects of HIV, the HIV epidemic in Southern Africa in particular. Then we will hear from Ms. Lebo Ramafoko, who is senior manager of the Soul City series, a very important mass media institution, really, in South Africa that has, I think it's the most widely, I'm sure we'll hear about this, the most widely listened to and viewed program in the in South Africa, and she's responsible for the management of the Soul City multimedia health and development series. She's been working with the Soul City group since 1995, and has been involved in its success as an award-winning primetime television drama, a radio drama, a talk show supported by printed materials. So that's going to be fascinating for those of us who've been watching behavioral interventions for quite a while. And then our last speaker will be Dr. Derek von Bissel, who is Swazi, and he is his own multisectoral AIDS program. Dr. von Bissel has been Minister of Finance of Swaziland, Minister of Health, Minister for Commerce, Industry and Mines, and today he is the director of the National Emergency Response Council on HIV/AIDS for Swaziland, and is a very strong advocate of prevention as a component of a comprehensive response to HIV. So I think you'll see we have a diverse panel with expertise in various parts of the response in Southern Africa. I think it'll be interesting in our discussion. I know that not all of you are based in the Southern Africa, where there is a generalized high-level epidemic. So perhaps in our discussion we can talk about how the ideas and lessons that emerge from this panel would be inflected or applied in other epidemiologic situations. And that we'll also hear from you in commenting on the ideas and the evidence that is presented here. And we're going to make a real effort to leave enough time for discussion. So our speakers will have 10 to 12 minutes each for their presentations, and I am going to be a terribly vicious moderator, aided by little green and red lights up here. So. I think so that we leave enough time for discussion. So without further ado, let me ask Dr. Wilson to take the floor.
Thank you very much. A major theme of this conference is the sheer diversity of HIV, and as our measurement improves, we are learning how heterogeneous HIV truly is. And this map of Africa underscores the point. We often think of Africa as uniformly stricken by HIV, but if we look at this map, major parts of Africa, in fact, have relatively low epidemics. And recent data suggest that even Ethiopia, Africa's second largest country, may only have a prevalence of about 1%. And I think we need to look at the Southern African heartland to try and understand what generates hyperepidemics. It's the only region we've seen HIV reach 15 to 30%. And this graph underscores the diversity, the three epidemics of Africa. Let's ask why briefly. I think the first reason is the role of acute infection and concurrent sexual partnerships. And this well-known graph shows how infectious we are immediately after we get HIV. And Marie Waver's work from Rakai suggests that up to half of all the infections over an eight-year period may have been acquired in the first few weeks or months after we seroconvert. And we now have behavioral data on the structure of sexual partnerships globally. And I think they help to explain why Africa may have such a severe epidemic. Even though Africans don't report more partners than anyone else in the world, the structures are different, with concurrent partnerships as the graph shows, far more common in Africa and greatest in southern Africa, where the epidemic is worst. And we have a recent study from Lekoma Island in Lake Malawi, which I think illustrates the sexual patterns we're tackling. In this very careful sexual networking study, they found a fifth of the population were in mutually faithful relationships, but two-thirds were linked by one single chain of exposure over the last 3 years. And what's important is those chains weren't held together by sex workers or core transmitters, but rather by decentralized, robust, complex chains of sexual networks. And I think that challenges a lot of our conceptions of HIV in Southern Africa as being sustained by vulnerable groups. The obvious role of male circumcision, which I'll spend just a moment on, we have the meta-analytic evidence, the ecological studies, and the Orange Farm trial. And if we take the UNAIDS antenatal data and compare highly circumcised and highly non-circumcised countries in Africa, we see an extraordinary difference. So I would suggest to us today that concurrent sexual partnerships and the absence of male circumcision are the lethal explosive cocktail which created Southern Africa's truly unique epidemics, which we are, in my view, utterly unlikely to see anywhere else in the world, ever. I'd now like to turn to HIV trends and their programmatic implications. And as Barbara said, we've been working in this field for over 2 decades, and when we look back at it, we got a lot wrong. I'd like to look first at declining HIV prevalence in generalized epidemics. And we've got impressive declines, which Kent touched upon, in Uganda, Kenya, and Zimbabwe. We've got declines in urban areas of several other African cities. And we've got some encouraging declines from the Caribbean. And if we look at the science graph from East Africa, it shows many cities in East Africa are experiencing HIV declines. Encouraging. But a word of caution. Look at the same graph for Southern Africa. No such declines. Historically, Uganda is the first country which gave us hope that we could reverse HIV, as these declines in antenatal prevalence show. And when we look at the behaviors that contributed to them, I think that these data suggest a major role for B, partner reduction, a contributory role for A, deferred sexual inception, and some role for condom use, but perhaps less than the other two in this context. And Kenya, where we're starting to see a similarly encouraging decline, and where we have high-quality behavioral data, paints a somewhat similar prediction picture. And if we look at the ABCs in Kenya, I think that the biggest decline we observe is in fact in B, in numbers of partners, with supporting declines in A and C. And turning to Zimbabwe, where we see more recent declines in HIV, but with a word of caution, to still appalling levels. We're still talking of a decline to approximately 20%. And data, which Kent touched on, from Manicaland in eastern Zimbabwe, suggesting that among men, perhaps the biggest changes were again in B, with rather modest changes in C. And among women, perhaps a similar pattern. Changes primarily in B and A. I'd like to just turn to concentrated epidemics to see what lessons they may hold. And we've seen HIV decline, in my view, in all the 3 countries in Asia which have sexually generated rather than drug-initiated epidemics: Thailand, Cambodia, and South India. And if we look at Thailand, we see a steep decline in HIV prevalence and modeled incidence. And we see it's associated with a well-known and I think accurately depicted growth in condom use to almost 90%. So there's no doubt that very high rates of condom use in commercial sex played an important role in Thailand. What's less often noticed is the red bar, showing that the number of Thais who visited sex workers fell precipitately from 60% to 20%. And that's a pretty rational reaction to a lethal sexually transmitted epidemic. Similarly, if we look here, we see how well the relationship between condom use and STIs illustrates the role of condoms in behavior change in Thailand and gives us an entry to data from Cambodia. And I think this slightly busy graph is important. What it shows is declining HIV prevalence among sex workers and the police in Thailand. It shows a big decline in unprotected sex among both sex workers and police, and it's very consistent with Thailand in this respect. So we can so far deduce that prevalence fell and that condom use rose. What's also less often recognized is the orange bar, that the number or the percentage of police visiting sex workers in Thailand fell enormously from almost 80%, and that's a staggering figure in a society where 80% of police report visiting sex workers, to 40%. So Thailand and Cambodia present a picture where condom use played a critical role, but a reduction in the number of men visiting sex workers played a role that we haven't perhaps acknowledged enough. And at this juncture, I think I'd just like to briefly ask, why does partner reduction appear to have a larger effect than many of us, certainly I 20 years ago, perhaps Barbara, had anticipated? And I think there's a clue in a recent model from Martha Morris and her colleagues from the University of Washington. And she looks here at the effect of numbers of partners on transmission networks. And the important thing about this model is small differences in the mean numbers of partners can translate to big differences in network densities. And if we just talk about the slightly busy graph for a moment, with 1.68 partners, she found 2% of people fell into the largest single component, and nobody was linked in a bi-component, which brings together different components. But As the mean number of partners rose modestly to 1.74, we found 10% in the largest component and 1% in a linked bimodal component. 1.8 partners brought us 41% in one component and 5% in interconnected components. And 1.86 changed the network density completely. And so the reason I cite this model is it does suggest that relatively small changes in numbers of partners can disrupt transmission cores more than we intuitively perceive. In conclusion, I'd just like to reemphasize that HIV is far more diverse than we recognized, that Southern Africa's epidemics are globally unique, and I think we have to ask ourselves why. And in answer to that question, I do think that concurrent sexual partnerships and the absence of male circumcision perhaps created perfect storm conditions for Southern Africa's hyperepidemics. Encouragingly, HIV is falling in many areas, but sadly, there's less decline in Southern Africa than elsewhere. We have some evidence of declines in Central Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Malawi, but very little in the deep Southern African SACU country areas. I think we can draw encouragement that behavior change has been the major cause of declines in HIV epidemics globally, whether in Africa or in Asia. And I think that's important because I think we stand at the edge of an area where we may be seduced with technologies and with complex and expensive interventions. And it's salutary to remind ourselves that Uganda reversed HIV 20 years ago in post-conflict conditions with very little resources through leadership and cultural change. I think it's true to say that partner reduction is the major single cause of HIV reduction in generalized epidemics, and that when we turn to concentrated epidemics, primarily condom use, but with a major supporting role for partner reduction, fewer men visiting sex workers, are the major causes of HIV declines. I'd like to end by suggesting that large-scale changes in risk-disposing behaviors are fundamental to changing HIV prevalence. And I'd like to end with a smoking cessation analogy. And colleagues of mine working in the smoking field say repeatedly, we had to denorm smoking in the wider adult population before focused interventions for young people or specific populations could ever work. And I think this is a perfect analogy with HIV. We have to denorm multiple partners, unprotected sex, exploitative male relations, predatory male behavior. We have to create norms of male responsibility before we can have an effect with supporting interventions. Thank you.
Before you go, are there any questions of specifically clarification for Dr. Wilson before we move on? Okay, terribly, completely, perfectly clear. Dr. Leclerc Madlala, please.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you. My talk is going to focus on the social and gender context of HIV transmission and prevention in the high prevalence Southern Africa region, but much of what I say has relevance throughout the sub-Saharan region, rather as opposed to just the Southern Africa region. A few initial points that have been made: that infection is primarily occurring heterosexually, but having said that, we know that homosexuality carries a high stigma in the area, and we know very little about transmission through people who are privately homosexual, publicly heterosexual. And I think that kind of transmission is more prevalent than is credited. High rates of HIV are resulting from normative everyday practices. A point that the former speaker has made, exotic practices are not the issue. However, there are certain ritual activities throughout the region that are not helpful in the context of AIDS, like wife inheritance, widow cleansing, sexual initiation, but their overall contribution to the spread of HIV is probably small. Structural and systemic gender inequalities determine women's greater vulnerability in the region. Feminization of poverty and the feminization of HIV mirror one another. And young women especially are vulnerable, almost three times so in the age group between 15 and 24 years. And the patriarchal social inheritance plus poverty together is a deadly combination that places severe constraints on women's decision-making abilities. And it's those two factors alone that largely account for the fact that most HIV prevention efforts in the subregion are failing. Okay. The current social and gender context is shaped by a number of factors, and we could speak for days about these factors, but for the purposes of my short presentation, I've grouped the areas of influence into three: custom and tradition, historic processes, modern trends, and I've selected five or six aspects of those areas that I think are especially pertinent to the problem of HIV transmission and prevention. Bear in mind that all of these influences are interlinked and they work together in a systemic way, and we'll consider some of them together. The first one, custom and tradition. Most all of the societies in the high prevalent countries are traditionally patrilineal. Inheritance is passed through the male line, they're patrilocal, whereby the bride at marriage was taken to the husband's family homestead to live. This pattern is important because it establishes the social organizational structure upon which the patriarchal values and ways of thinking that prevail in the subregion rest. They provide the conditions for the power imbalances in favor of men and the social values that uphold male privilege. Traditionally, the men were head of households and homesteads, in charge of women and children who were dependent on them. Men's activities were not to be questioned, and when women did question those activities, it was a great sign of disrespect. The women's behavior was closely governed by codes of respect in most societies that called for deference and subordination. Though things have changed, these cultural ideals persist, and they provide conditions for those power imbalances. The gendered mixed economy, most of the societies traditionally practiced pastoralism. It was men who occupied themselves with herding and cattle, women involved in agriculture. There were sharp divisions of labor. And this had implications for the way children were socialized and how they were socialized, mostly communally within families, older brothers and sisters, age mates were taken together at the time of puberty for ritual purposes, and local elders existed to help with that process. And we'll look more at that when we discuss the historic changes. Polygyny, a system that allowed men to have as many wives as they could afford and maintain. It's generally on the wane, especially in urban areas, but the sexual networking patterns of polygamy still remain. And one could argue that the common pattern of concurrent multiple partnerships that are found throughout the subregion are a natural evolution of the formal polygamous system. So we have a situation today in many places where it's monogamy de jure but polygyny de facto, where legally there's one wife, but in practice there's many wives or girlfriends, as they're called today. Also, I would add that polygyny helps to legitimate intergenerational sex. We have many examples of polygynous married chiefs and kings who have four or five wives, and wife number four and five is of a generation that's oftentimes of their grandchildren. So it provides a cultural reference point for intergenerational sex. The largest bride wealth, the value of bride wealth across the subcontinent varies considerably, and throughout southern Africa it's quite large, traditionally 10 to 11 cows. What this does is that it places a large amount of rights in the hands of the man's family over the women and children. And while bride wealth is not a problem per se, it's a problem when it becomes used to justify things like domestic violence, which it is, men's control, and avoidance of safe sexual practices. Both men and women oftentimes say, well, my husband can do that. He has, after all, paid lobola for me. So it's dangerous in that, at the context in which it is referred to today. It also provides cultural reference for transactional sex. The exchange of sex for gifts, favors, or money is a normative expectation in most non-married relationships in the region. And it occurs for a range of purposes, from survival sex to secure basic needs like food and shelter, to consumptive sex, exchange of sex for cell phones and fashionable clothing. And it's not just boys and girls who engage in these relationships. And it's not just rich sugar daddies and mommies. Neither. Less well-off men with their offers of biscuits and makeups partake in intergenerational and the transactional sex. The bimoral cosmology, traditional illness and misfortune, was seen as a result of a failure to fulfill some kind of religious cultural obligation and had a supernatural dimension. And this belief system is still very much intact, and it coexists with other belief systems and scientific explanations. And its importance lies in the fact that it contributes to the deep ambivalences and the widely inconsistent views that people hold on HIV/AIDS. While they can believe that it's caused or transmitted through unsafe sexual practices, they also believe that it's a result of witchcraft, too. Historic processes, the heritage of colonialism throughout the area and some places apartheid, has played a big role in shaping the current context. For one thing, I would say that the ghost of these two systems fundamentally constrains thinking and acting on behavioral change, and I mean sexual behavioral change, at all levels from leadership to the local level. For example, colonial racist representations of Africans as diseased and hypersex are often recalled in public debates on issues related to sexuality and sexual violence. And this has the effect of making people refrain from exploring and discussing these issues. And this in itself presents a huge challenge to policy and programming on HIV prevention in the sub-region. Also, these two systems help to normalize structural violence as a way of solving problems. Sexual violence throughout southern Africa is quite common, In one study, recent study, it's been estimated that 30% of adults have experienced coerced sex before the age of 18, and the victims and perpetuators are getting younger. One study in Soweto recently showed that almost 25% of the perpetuators of child abuse, the perpetuators, not the victims, were children under age 14. Children. The cash economy and labor mobility we can consider together. They went hand in hand, undermined family life considerably. Some studies reveal how bride wealth value increased progressively, leading to less marriage, more casual partners. Men's role as household was head of households was undermined. Increasingly, men becoming marginal to the process, dependent on women, and disruption in the traditional methods of socializing children. The result today is there's very little dialogue in the homes around issues of sexuality and very little dialogue between boys and adult men. And Christianity, along with the two above, premarital sex equated with sin and the old ways of regulating youth sexuality through things like non-penetrative sex, which was quite common, fell away and nothing really replaced them. The biomedical epistemology that came along, for the most part, it's an altogether very different perspective on health and illness, and it's inadequate from a cultural point of view. And therefore, people do seek alternative explanations and therapies for disease, including HIV. Health-seeking behavior is very pluralistic. Finally, the modern trends, consumer values have grown rapidly in the area. A situation exists today where new needs and wants are being created, but the means to acquire those needs and wants are not being created at the same pace. One effect is that it propels young people into transactional sexual relationships and intergenerational relationships. The foreign media imagery in many working-class homes, the television is on 7 hours a day, like the radio used to be previously. Images portray the easy, glamorous life. The bold and beautiful is very popular, and you wonder if the people on those programs ever really go to work. And when they do go to work, they stare at images of their loved ones. So it creates impossible expectations. And I would also say it contributes to a pervasive resignation that exist amongst parents. Parents feel that the life of their children and what they're being exposed to is so vastly different from what they know that they can't possibly have anything that could help them and guide them. So many parents are basically resigned in their parenting, and I don't think that that's a good trend at all. The widening wealth differentials, the urbanization without employment go together. Studies tell us that the gap between rich and poor is growing. And one result is a growing pool of poor people, poor women who are willing to trade sex and to partake in the good life, and a growing pool of men willing and able to exploit that situation. And while urbanization is not new, what is different is that people are flocking to the cities and there's no jobs for them. So that's contributing to the whole range of the issues we've been discussing. And finally, changing role of women, and here I'll take on my feminist brothers and sisters. Men's role and authority in the households and societies has been progressively undermined since the colonial era. And it's fair to say that many, if not most men in the region, view the new gender order, the new gender expectations for equality, as a continuation of their historic dethroning. And one can only wonder how much of the high rates of gender-based violence, rape, child abuse, which are all too common across the region, are directly or indirectly related to this type of historic psychic trauma of men that has never been addressed. And that's why I believe strongly that we need to focus a lot more of our attention on men. And concluding then, the gendered societal context is a major underlying factor, and unless we match our scientific and financial commitment with commitments to human development and the modification of that context, then I don't think we'll make as much headway in combating this disease as we'd like. HIV efforts to carry the potential for reducing risk have to account for the aspects of the context, including social norms, values, and beliefs, and economic disadvantages. And I think there is an urgent need for a contextually informed, holistic, long-term strategic response to HIV. And I would add balanced approach that puts a major stress on men's roles and responsibilities in this epidemic. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McClurk-Midlala. In our first two presentations, we've heard Dr. Wilson talk about the quantitative, the refinement of the prevention paradigm that can be derived from detailed quantitative analysis through population-based surveys and methods such as network analysis. And I hope you all were as impressed as I was when I first saw the slide on, or the information that the difference between an average of 1.8 sexual partners and 1.86 sexual partners could make the difference, such an enormous difference in the interconnectedness of a sexual network, and the implications of that for communicating to people about what kinds of changes in their own lives could cumulatively make an enormous difference at the epidemic, on the epidemic, I think it's pretty remarkable. And in Dr. Leclerc-Madlala's presentation, we see some of the refinements that can come from unpacking this concept of cultural specificity and looking in detail at how the present is shaped by the past and how concerns and constraints about historic trends can actually influence the space within which people think about the options that they have for modifying their behavior and for improving the lives of their communities and their families. We're going to now shift to hear from Ms. Ramafoko, who's going to talk about a program that is world-renowned for successfully blending the goals of entertainment and improving the public health and welfare. Please, Ms. Ramafoko.
Thank you. I think Dr. Wilson and Dr. Madlala basically laid a very solid foundation for what I want to talk about. I think the challenges that we have had suggest that we need a social revolution to deal with the real drivers of HIV in South Africa, as they have suggested. At a meeting in May in this year, the SADC countries in Southern Africa identified the following as key drivers of the epidemic: unequal gender relations, concurrent sexual partners, sexual violence, intergenerational sex, transactional sex due to poverty and deepening social and economic inequality, and alcohol misuse. If one looks at concurrent partners as a key to the epidemic, one, as Dr. Wilson suggested, begins to understand that on average, Africans are not having more partners than people in Europe and North America. But what is particular about Southern Africa is that people seem to be having more than one partner at the same time. And these are often relatively stable and long-term relationships. This is fine if it is a closed system, but devastating if it opens up. And I think Dr. Wilson painted the picture very vividly for us, so I'm going to just jump through this. This just shows how if one person in the network is or becomes positive and is highly infectious in the first 6 weeks, what the implications are for everybody else in the network. And that is why I'm suggesting that we need a social revolution. But what is the social revolution? I think we need commitment at all levels of society that this is the direction that we are going to take in terms of our prevention messages. I think we need to synergize our messages. At the very least, even if we are saying different messages, we should all be driving at all our participants, our target audience, looking at the whole issue of concurrent partners and the other key drivers. We need multiple levels of intervention at scale. We also need well-thought-out and evidence-based communication across all sectors of society, and we need social mobilization. At this point, I will turn to what the role of social change communication can be. SoulCity acknowledges that while most communication is targeted at the individual, more often it is the factors that influence that individual that are happening at a community level and at a broader socio-economic level that basically are indicators on whether or not an individual can make behavior or change their behavior. Health and development communication draws on both behavior change theory as well as health promotion theory. In its understanding of change, both these sources of influence look at social context, thereby firmly placing behavior in the context of social contracts such as culture, values, tradition, experience, and education. Several social scientists propose social influence as a key mechanism of change. Social influence, social comparison, and convergence theories specify that the perceptions and behavior of peers or other types of reference groups influence one's perception and behavior. Especially in uncertain or ambiguous situations, people rely on the opinions of others. Thus, theories of social change, of social influence, look at the importance of social networks in behavior change. It proposes that the degree of social interconnectedness determines the likelihood of exposure to new ideas and behavior, and determines the degree of social comparison and influence. Many of these theories look at mass media as a significant social influence, able to shape and legitimize social norms and personal beliefs. Impacting on attitudes and beliefs is an important objective of communication for social change interventions. Despite the fact that it is well documented that positive attitudes in themselves do not directly predict healthy behavior, behavior change theories and models retain positive shifts in attitudes and beliefs amongst their explanatory variables. The Busneff model is a good example. John Hubley relates influences and actions to a Busneff model, and Busneff stands for beliefs, attitudes, subjective norms, and enabling factors. According to this model, an individual will take up a new practice when he or she believes that the practice has sufficient benefits, health or otherwise, and considers these benefits important. He or she may then develop a positive attitude to the change. Influences or subjective norms from others in the person's environment who are important to him or her will also influence their decision to try or not to try this new practice. Skills, times, and means, or enabling factors, are also required to take up the practice. At SoulCity, we analyzed our fourth series, which dealt with one topic that was also a norm in our society, which was domestic violence, where the held belief was that domestic violence was a right, the woman needed to be controlled by the husband, that it was a private affair, therefore you would not intervene when a husband is beating up the wife. And the analysis of the SoulCity 4 evaluation results examined the nature of the relationship between attitudes, beliefs, and desired behavior. It suggests that beliefs play a role through a more complex causal pathway than often assumed in the literature. Although a direct association between positive personal beliefs and behavior may be inconsistent or weak, personal beliefs in interaction with perceptions of one's reference group's beliefs may play a significant role in impacting on positive behavior and intention through interpersonal discussion as an intermediate social process. The analysis further documents the influence of mass media communication on subjective norms, interpersonal communication and debate, and ultimately on desired behavior. An evidence-based argument is made for using mass media to impact on social norms and individual beliefs as an important mechanism in bringing about the social change. Exposure to SoulCity Series 4 associated with significant positive shifts in subjective norms. It associated with exposure to Seoul City Series 4 associated with significant positive shifts in discussion on the issue and associated with significant positive shifts in intention with positive behavior. Therefore, mass media communication interventions can and do impact on subjective norms, interpersonal communication, and debate, and then ultimately desired behavior change through a number of mechanisms. Through a drama series, you can model the desired behavior. You can show through story the choices and the consequences of choices, whether good consequences or bad consequences. There is a parasocial interaction. There is deep emotional engagement that audiences have with the characters and through their legitimizing effect. But what should the common message be? Whatever the message is, I want to argue that it must address gender inequality by focusing on male involvement, responsibility, accountability, and accountability for HIV prevention. I think, as Dr. Madlala has indicated, it needs to address the fears that men have around the whole issue of gender equality and women empowerment. But how can we communicate this? I want to argue, after a number of years of experience in doing mass media communication, that pretesting is important. There is a big gap between research that understands that concurrent partnership or gender equality drives the epidemic and telling stories that resonate with audiences. So whatever the messages are, we need to make sure that the audiences understand the message in the way that it was intended to be understood. In other words, we need to make sure that we do not victim blame. We understand where our audiences come from. We understand what are the stories that would resonate. We understand why women would stay in relationships where they know that their partners are having other partners. And we tell stories or we give messages that would resonate with their realities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ramafoko, for that extremely rich presentation that ties the powerful theoretical background with the very powerful application that has been a huge contribution to the whole region. And now, Dr. Von Wissel.
Madam Chair, ladies and gentlemen, I've been asked to just give an example of a behavior change campaign which we have started running since mid last year in Swaziland. And as you have heard this morning, the academic discourse about how to prevent HIV is a very diverse one and a very complex one. And when you're in the field and confronted with all these different views and everybody's theories and everybody knows better how to do what, one on the ground has to take some certain decisions. And if I can work the technology. And these decisions you have to eventually account for. And we took some early decisions, and that was to prioritize our target audience for immediate impact. And by that we're saying that what the concept was to go for the multiple concurrent partners. That is the evidence that we have at the moment, and we focused on that rather than on abstinence, because the science tells us that abstinence eventually ends up in a little bubble and everybody sort of reaches the same level of infection anyway. So the target audience was sexually active people. The local socio-cultural context, I think Dr. Madlala covered that one extremely well, because this has been worrying us very much. All those different influences and the different impacts that have happened on the society, and you have to communicate within that context, within that society. And what we also did is we tried to use the commercial techniques that the commercial world uses. If you can still buy a cigarette with a pack on it saying that this will kill you, and you still continue to buy, there must be something in the technique of communication that can teach us something. So the problem, the multiple concurrent partners, as has been stated repeatedly, newly infectious transmitters, as stated, intergenerational sex, societal value changes, as Dr. Matlala referred to, sex is the driver of the epidemic. One must never ever think that or take sex out of the equation. That is what is driving the epidemic in Southern Africa, and we have to recognize that. And then the danger of the sex networks, as David Wilson explained in Malawi, and I just repeating his slide there. So in the execution, we try to be, caveat that and say, we divided prevention into two areas. One, the biomedical interventions, and the other, the behavior change intervention. The biomedical ones are the PMTCT, safe blood and condoms, and all those interventions that are known but have to be scaled up. The work that we are trying to do is get into the behavior change side and try and the other ones must continue. They must be scaled up. But we are doing too little. We have learned that purely providing people with information does not change behavior. So you have to try and get into the behavior change side. The execution was bold, confrontational, explicit. On the first campaign, we had a decision, a reason why, and the fear factor. I think the fear factor has been repeatedly discussed and has been seen to be effective. The main medium in Southern Africa or in Swaziland is radio, and maybe in South Africa television is stronger, but the strongest medium in Swaziland is radio, and then supported by press and billboards and posters and TVs, and also drama, cultural drama, and things like that. Particularly interesting is that Gudlinhlogo down there, which is a cultural practice where men gather together on their own after a feast to eat the head and the feet, and that becomes a particularly effective communications medium. And we've used it, and it with great effect. So the first Ligusasa campaign, which is this one up here, concentrated the yellow means because of my future. And the I choose to have one sex partner was the decision I've taken, and because of my future, and then casual sex is dangerous and HIV kills. So that was the basis of the and that is the visual side. The there was also the radio and other media, but it had a couple of layers. You had the visual and the commercial or 30-second spots and those kind of things, and then it came down into radio and radio programming and interpersonal exchanges. That was the female version of it, and this had an element of empowerment of women in there, and again saying the same story. My red light has come on. Again, the next level was the Makwapeni campaign. Makwapeni means your secret lover. And saying that the secret lover is the one that is driving the epidemic. And there we had using text message and SMS messaging imagery. So the visual stuff doesn't look very good, but when you look at it, you'll see that it looks like a cell phone text message coming through, and then the danger, and then the baseline that this secret lover is the one that will eventually destroy you on your the same in Siswati. This campaign caused a lot of controversy. Unfortunately, I believe it was misinterpreted, and I think that we didn't adequately pretest the messaging. We did some pretesting, but I think the Cell City point that they must do in-depth pretesting to be able to get the proper messaging across. And then we moved on now to a next set of messages, which is again using the text concept, and then casual sex is dangerous, HIV kills at the bottom line. Now, after running the campaign for some weeks, there was huge national debate on the Makwapeni campaign, the secret lover story. There's almost 100% awareness throughout the country amongst adult people of the campaign. And 80%, more than 80% of the people understood the message. And we've just done another survey last week, and the results are preliminary, but they are saying that it has had the effect of people reconsidering their behavior, and we're hoping that eventually this will show in the decline in multiple concurrent partners. Thank you very much.
Well, we've had a very diverse set of presentations here that put some issues into focus for us. As I mentioned earlier, the range of data that can be used and indeed can profitably be used to take a more detailed and refined view of what is the HIV problem in a given national and more local setting. Trying to understand the levels of factors that influence behavior, individual, community, social, and both normative factors and also sort of material environment factors. And then utilizing the history that we've had in trying to influence behavior to improve health and social development. It's not an easy process. If it were easy, the epidemic would be over. I think we can all say that. But the combination of the uses of ethnographic and survey data and the application of that in a policy context has been, I think, well illustrated by our speakers. So let's have some questions from the floor. Are there any? Let's go one, two to start with, and three to start with. Yeah, please. And yes, use the mic because we're. So everyone can hear.
Hello. Yes, it's working. I'm Bernard Gardner from the International Federation of Red Cross. I'm just wondering, given there's a tradition around multiple partners, there are obviously strengths in that, in terms of people being connected with each other, socially, emotionally. There must be, you know, this didn't happen without a reason. It's deeply embedded in the culture and must have served a function for a very long time as a positive thing, I would imagine. So the approach here seems to be to make a dramatic cultural shift to people no longer having those support networks in the way that they had before. Is that going to have a consequence that that we're not looking at? And would it actually be possible that introducing condoms into that network would enable the cultural strength to survive and HIV to not be transmitted? And I'm just wondering also on some of the data around the levels of impact of reduction of partners, how much that's occurring in a context where that's the only option that's really available to people because condoms are just not there.
Thank you for that interesting question, which I think points out that there are always multiple interventions that to influence the result of the multiple partner behavior pattern, which is not, I think your point is that it's not inherently negative and could have inherent benefits, but in the context of a sexually driven epidemic, it could be the negative consequences could be interrupted by condoms. Can we have comments let's see, Suzanne, do you want to comment?
A few things.
There. Certainly, polygyny traditionally served those functions, as you mentioned, and amongst the kings it was a way of nation building, and it still is in Swaziland. You know, you take wives from different regions as a way of consolidating. But more so, it did play a role in social support in a very different context. In a rural agricultural context, it was a way to help foster that type of social security. When we think of wife inheritance, for example, that's what it was about. You know, the man died and you and your children were looked after. Now we have a very different kind of context. And many women object to that system. Some still want it. That's fine. But it's problematic in the current situation that we find ourselves in today. Introducing condoms into that mixture, yes, indeed, potentially it could be very effective. But the important word here is potentially. I think what we found in Southern Africa, on average we have about 18% condom coverage throughout the region. And if we really, really work hard, maybe we could increase that by another 10% to 28%. But it's still not going to have the protective impact that we really need to reverse this epidemic.
Any of our other speakers want to comment on this? No, then let's, thank you. Let's take our, did you want to comment? Please, go ahead.
Thanks. Thank you very much. A very thoughtful question. Just a sentence on the second part of the question as to whether partner reduction occurred because condoms weren't available. I think that's probably an accurate reading of early Uganda. But I do think that Zimbabwe and Kenya had some of the best condom promotion programs and the highest distributions per capita. And I don't think partner reduction was the only option available in either Zimbabwe or Kenya, or as Lebo is adding, elsewhere in Southern Africa.
I think the problem with condom use that we are seeing in South Africa is the consistent and correct use of condoms, and also the cultural barrier. And I think it's partly because of paying lobola, that once I have paid for my wife, why would I need to use condoms? And people reflecting that, in fact, these concurrent partners, people are not making a difference between the wife that I have married and a long-term stable relationship. So in the first month, there may be condom use, which are freely available. And after a month or so, there is a feeling or a perception of we trust each other, therefore. And the danger is if any one of those people in that system goes out and gets HIV, the result is disastrous for everybody else who perceive of themselves being in safe, stable, loving relationships.
Well, I'll just mention, I'll take the moderator's prerogative to mention that none of our speakers have talked extensively about voluntary counseling and testing or counseling and testing. And the one of the reasons that I've been an adherent for such a long time is that the conviction that that the change from sort of probabilistic thinking that, oh, well, the rate of HIV in my community is such and such, and individual thinking, as in what do I have to do right now, can really be made by knowing your HIV status and creating an environment where it's safe for people to know their actual HIV status is, I think, a very high priority that we have. Please, Arden. And for anyone who has questions, if you could just join that line because it's hard to see from here and I don't want to lose track of people who we've identified as.
My name is Martine Koop. I'm from Zambia. It was a very interesting set of presentations that kept your thinking. If you're looking at the encouraging fact that in Kenya and in Zimbabwe, the figures are going down, and especially in the reduction of multiple partners, I was wondering, are they using interventions that are not used in the rest of Southern African region, or are the interventions that they use failing and need different interventions in the rest of Southern Africa?
Please, David.
Just a short sentence, and I'm sure others will contribute. I think that Uganda definitely focused on partner reduction, but if we look at Kenya and Zimbabwe, and I worked in Zimbabwe for 20 years and in fact worked in the Manikelam program that was cited, my honest summary would be we were largely promoting condoms, but people were actually drawing the conclusion of partner reduction. So I think the message largely happened because of overall awareness, but in spite of our specific recommendations.
Do we have other speakers who want to comment? I'll just echo that by saying that in having been involved in a collaborative project in Uganda in the late 80s, I remember reviewing the results of the pretest of the survey instrument, where the question was asked, which is very traditional at that time, have you changed your behavior because of AIDS? And in our little pretest sample, the vast majority of men and women said yes. And when asked, how have you changed your behavior, a very large proportion of the women said, I'm not having sex now. I've just stopped having sex. And, you know, we can all joke about the, honey, I have a headache, but that strategy has been used by many individuals over time, and yet it's only now that we're starting to get a handle on how one could take a public health intervention approach to promoting something that was really deemed personal behavior and kind of off the plan for a long time. Please, our next question.
All right, my first question is for Ken Hill. And in looking at
Could you just mention your...
Sure. My name's David Garden. I'm from the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. In the countries that you all have been working in, has there been any scientifically based evidence that says that any of the prevention in any of the PEPFAR countries, that the prevention needs of any particular country require 33% of funds directed to that country should be for abstinence? And my other question is for all the panelists. In a finite pot of money, should any prevention method take precedence over another? So, for example, should abstinence take precedence over PMTCT type prevention services?
Okay. Let me address the percentage question first. The percentage was an attempt by Congress to ensure that we had as part of our strategy abstinence, which they have allowed us to interpret because our programs often are abstinence and be faithful that had to do with that part of the comprehensive strategy. It was an attempt to make sure that we didn't just distribute condoms, and so they put that in the legislation. In terms of what we've actually seen on the ground in implementing this, I think the most important thing to say is that even now, if you put the A, B together and then you put the C, which has always been a big part of the program, has been even bigger during the Bush administration than it was during the previous administration, I don't think the evidence would suggest that it's not an appropriate percentage. I wouldn't put the percentage at 33% specifically for abstinence necessarily. The part that there ought to be a major percentage, at least that high on A and B together, would make it a comprehensive strategy. So I think the key is all of those interventions. What I think disturbs me a little bit is I've been very discouraged by the international debate over the comprehensive strategy of ABC. I'm particularly disturbed to hear over and over again the assertion that the United States has an abstinence-only policy, which has never been the case, will never be the case. And the fact that we're expected to use a certain percentage of our comprehensive strategy on A and B makes all the sense in the world. I'm disturbed that out of every dollar that PEPFAR spends, in a sense, 85 cents of it doesn't have anything to do with sexual prevention at all. Now, I understand why that's the case. There's treatment, and you're absolutely right to say that preventing mother-to-child's transmission ought to be a big part of what we do. We want it to be a big part. Working with other at-risk groups like drug users needs to be part of the portfolio, as does blood safety and all the other things we're trying to do. But if you look at the total amount, the percentage of the portfolio that goes to sexual prevention, of which a part is A and B, it's really a quite modest percentage. I think the international community ought to consider, since we are still losing the battle on the number of new infections, whether, in fact, the international community, including the United States, needs to find a way to scale up prevention right across the board, all sorts of prevention activities, because we're still losing that battle.
Is this microphone on? Can we use this one as well?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't.
That's okay.
I'm blinded. I can't even see that.
No problem.
Let's have one final quick comment from you.
I think just a very short sentence. Both the evidence and I think the experience of us working in the field, and like myself, working primarily on condom promotion programs with vulnerable groups, is that I think globally we have underinvested in A and B.
Gary Myers, York University here in Toronto. First off, I'd just like to say thank you very much for a very interesting presentation and your views. Throughout this conference, there seems to be this tension that's occurring between human sexual rights and prevention programs. And my listening to this, my concern is, how do we bridge that gap? How do we bring the two sides together to actually overcome the divisiveness that's occurring, because we are fighting for the same cause? One of the things that I would like to point out as well, the campaign, Casual Sex is Dangerous campaign, I would suggest that probably one of the things that was missing, which I think was pointed out by one of the other questioners, was casual sex is dangerous, ... without a condom, and that really was missing in that. So again, it's the ideas of condom use, abstinence, that tension is there. How do we also overcome that tension along with the ideas of prevention and human sexual rights?
I think that was a very well-framed question. Tensions are inherent to cultural stability and cultural change. So let's, do we have a comment from our panelists?
Only to say that we did consider the condom issue, but the point is, casual sex is dangerous, full stop, whether it's with a condom or not, because the consistent condom use, as Social D has pointed out, is not there. You don't always have one. It's not available. Wrong use. One guy reported to his doctor that he forgot which pocket he put his condom in when it got so busy. So consistent condom use is not a realistic approach. So casual sex is dangerous, full stop.
David, do you want to?
Thanks very briefly. All I wanted to say is I agree completely with you. We should look for what we can find as unifying principles. And it seems to me that something that really unites many people, scientists, AB people, activists, rights-based people, is the issue of male responsibility, which you've heard from each of us in the panel. And I want to echo Suzanne's comments about the critical importance of promoting male responsibility and good male role models. And I think that's something that everybody can agree on, from a gender, from a rights, from a religious perspective. And it seems to me, and this is something Kent has promoted, it should be a unifying principle for our work. Just to echo Derek's point briefly, I think one critical success of Uganda's campaign was it was hard-hitting, it was direct, and it was simple. And I do think it's hard to give dual messages. I think that you can defend what Swaziland tried to do.
Just want to add one quick note on this. I think you're absolutely right to ask the question, are there ways we can bring the international community together? Because I think the divisive debate is the last thing we need at this point. There's too much at stake. And let me suggest one way that I think we could work together, that we could bring the left and the right, the religious and the non-religious together. And it has to do with gender-based human rights issues. You know, abstinence is often talked about in the sense that anybody who's talking about abstinence is number one, unrealistic. Number two, they've probably been pushed by the religious right to take this position. It's moralism, it's et cetera. But anybody who knows the context of the disease knows that often what's happening is, as a result of gender-based violence, coercive sex, girls who don't want to have sex as early as they want. I remember a Kenyan woman telling me one time, look, what we want is the right to abstain. It's a human rights issue. It's a human rights issue that the double standards between males and females stop. You have faithful women in relationships who are still getting infected. They've done the right thing. They've been faithful. The men have not. This is a human rights issue. This doesn't need to be put in the categories of a moralistic in the sense of religious right, religious left, political right, and left. If we focused on gender issues, you could not focus on gender issues without focusing on the A and B, particularly of A, B, and C, and also C. So I think there are ways to bring us together. We've got to put this divisive debate behind us. Too much is at stake.
Let's take another question from this side, because I didn't see you guys before. Sorry.
Thank you. My name's Healy Thompson. I'm with the Center for Health and Gender Equity in the U.S. And as one of the people who has said that the U.S. has an abstinence-only policy, I wanted to address first Mr. Hill's point about that. I don't think that the claim is not that the U.S. only spends money on abstinence, but rather that with certain populations, the only message that they're getting, specifically with youth, the only message that they're getting is to abstain. So that's the claim about abstinence only. But to continue to my question, I'm looking at the ABCs of HIV prevention, the handout that was given, and the way that we look at that, it's really we're looking at A or B or C. Abstain. If you're not abstaining, then be faithful to your partner. If you're not being faithful to your partner, then use a condom. Specifically, use a condom for casual sexual activity in other high-risk situations. But it looks like from the presentations today that what we're really talking about is not being faithful, but rather reducing sexual partners. And if that's what we're talking about, then one, why don't we call it like it is? And we lose the catchiness of ABC, but we're being accurate in talking about reducing sexual partners. And why don't we acknowledge that that intervention of reducing sexual partners, which we've called B before, needs to go with condom use? Because while we may be reducing risk by moving from that 1.8 sexual partners to 1.68, we're certainly not eliminating it. And people should be reducing sexual partners and using condoms. And wouldn't that require us to talk about C not just for casual sexual activity, because we're talking about long-term sexual partners, even if there's multiple ones, and not just for what people would define as high-risk situations. And if we remove some of that stigma around condoms by not talking about them just as that, wouldn't we make it more possible for people to start using condoms with their primary sexual partner instead of this idea that that's not a risky relationship, that's not my casual sex, so I don't need to use a condom?
Four quick points. On your first point, I appreciated that, that some of the critics don't mean that there's nothing besides abstinence as part of the U.S. strategy. You clarified it to say that you are upset that the U.S. policy is abstinence only with youth, with that particular audience. And I trust you'll be encouraged to know that, in fact, that's not what our youth programs are. There are very few, except you're talking to school children and young teenagers, that would focus on the abstinence. If you go to our the things that we fund with youth clubs, et cetera, there is discussion about safe sex as well as other interventions as well. So it is more comprehensive with youth than you may be aware, and I hope that helps you to feel better about that. The second thing I want to simply say is I think you're right about using a phrase like reducing the number of sex partners, if that's what we're trying to address, multiple concurrent relationships. I think that's absolutely fine. In fact, but I would say that whether you talk about fidelity, try to be faithful to one spouse within a marriage context, or for a person who's had maybe three or four partners to get them to at least reduce, it's still a spectrum. It's to be faithful to one or less number of partners than before, and however we do that, it's the right message. You suggested also that even if we do all these things, C ought to remain, condoms ought to remain. Fully agree, no question about it. C has got to be a part of the strategy. You can't have any only of anything. Abstinence only, be faithful only, condoms only, dealing with drug users only. You need it all. You need a comprehensive approach. You need condoms to be a part of it. And my fourth and final point is this. So maybe we ought to focus more on trying to get people in permanent relationships to use condoms every time. It's a nice idea. All the evidence I've read by the people who follow this sort of thing is they've had some success in trying to get condom use up in Asia and elsewhere with people involved in risky behavior, with prostitutes or sex workers, etc. They have had remarkably less success in trying to get people in more permanent relationships. And as was said earlier here, you can put that message out for a long time, but most people in more permanent relationships find it unrealistic or something they just don't do. So that probably, except that there's a discordant couple, I think hopefully we can get the message out better that they've simply got to do this. But my bottom line is that we have simply got to do it all. We have to do it all well.
Thank you, Ken. We have very little time. We have about 5 minutes, let me just take if we can have a short question and a short response. One more on this side, and then one more on this side, and then we're going to wrap up But anyone who has additional questions, I welcome you to come and talk with the panel after our session. Please.
Hi, I'm Adam Graham Silverman with Gay City News in New York, and a couple of quick things, or a couple of specific things. First of all, Dr. Leclerc-Madlolo, I was a little confused about what you said about condom penetration. You said it was about 18%, and that with a lot of effort, you could maybe boost that another 10 or 20%. Does that imply that condom penetration will never get beyond that, so that it's a and thus an ineffective strategy if it's never going to get any higher than, say, 38% or something like that? It sounds like it maybe I didn't understand, but under that comment was suggesting that it's not a very effective or promising approach, even if it were pushed really hard. And secondly,
and I'm afraid we can only really take one question because we have such limited time. So can I ask Suzanne to answer that one, and then we have to go to our other side.
Yeah, I think that's what I was suggesting, is that we haven't had much success in promoting the condom, and it's simply not a method that is readily accepted in the area. And we could increase it 10%, 20%, 30%, but because it's not used consistently and correctly, I don't think we can rely on condom promotion alone. We've got to seriously look at all the options that we have available and promote them all. Do it all well, as the previous speaker said.
If I can just comment on that, I encourage the audience to look at the data that have come out of the HBAC, or I think it's a community-based AIDS treatment, it's Prevention for Positives program in Uganda that has shown quite startling levels of condom use and reduction in transmission in discordant couples in a community-based prevention and treatment integrated program. Because I think it gets back to this question, if people are thinking probabilistically about, oh, well, maybe, then condom use is quite low. But the condom use within discordant couples, as Kent was saying, is remarkably good, which implies that if people know that there's a danger, and it's not a matter of maybe, then it's a whole different ballgame, and people will do what they need to save the lives of people that they love. Please.
Shahira Ahmed from the Program on International Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health. Although there is agreement among the panelists that the ABC approach is the way to go and is a comprehensive approach, but the half of the puzzle is missing, because you're putting the responsibility in men's hands, but then women can't do that. They don't have the power to sometimes abstain, just like you said, but there was nothing that was presented to tell us how. There are no funds that are being put towards that for women. And which takes me to a question on male circumcision that was kind of mentioned as another way to go, but there was no data on how male circumcision is an effective way, and I think it's a huge concern, because it's again giving the notion that, you know, if there's male circumcision, then men then don't have to do anything else. Thanks.
Lebo, do you want to make a comment first on the question of how and the question of the norms, trying to change the social norms, and then David on male circumcision?
Generally, with ABC and other of the key drivers that I presented, it would be a sad day if we picked on one. I think the idea of focusing does not mean that we do not address, for an example, gender inequality. And in addressing gender inequality, you would need to address the status of women. But I think the focus on male involvement suggests that over the years, we have done, for an example, women empowerment, and the feedback that we are getting from communities is men, one, not feeling that they can be accountable for the spread of HIV or take any responsibility. And it's merely a focus that does not take away from the promotion of the female condom, the promotion of condoms, the promotion of gender equality.
David?
Very briefly, I think the point you raised about male circumcision and what we call risk compensation or disinhibition, just feeling safe, is a very good point. And I think it's something we're going to have to face and program for in all that we do in future, not just in relation to male circumcision, but in relation to antiretroviral treatment, in relation to partial vaccines, in relation to antimicrobicidal and other agents. So I think we have to program for that environment. It's simply unavoidable. And briefly, in relation to male circumcision, it's also worth noting there's evidence that men receiving circumcision are approximately a third less likely to transmit HIV, as well as a range of STIs and cancer-disposing factors to their female partners. So there's a protective effect for women as well.
Just add one point. I liked your point very much that you have to take into account that there are often situations where women simply don't have control. And therefore you just can't have messages for them. The result of that is that part of your portfolio ought to be a robust program related to things like microbicides, which is why PEPFAR and USAID put so much money into that, and I'd love to spend more money on that because I think it's got to be a part of the portfolio. But at the end of the day, I want a situation where women don't have to use microbicides because their human rights are going to be violated. So I think we simultaneously need to work on the human rights part for women, even as we find ways to protect them better so they have more control over what happens to them.
Thank you. Well, I think we have to wrap up. This has been a very stimulating session, and I want to thank all the panelists for the excellent contributions, and thank you to our participants for your excellent questions. I want to leave you with a couple of questions myself. We've heard some very in-depth discussions of, or in-depth, some presentations of the in-depth knowledge of the quantitative data to analyze where the new infections are and why they're, where they're taking place and why. We've heard a very comprehensive view of the historical and contemporary factors that influence the social environment in which people live and that influence either directly or as a sort of in a indirect way the choices that they make. We've heard about the importance using that information to develop behavior change interventions that will resonate with people and hit them not only in their rational thinking selves, but also in the heart, and that will motivate them to change. And we've also heard about the challenges of putting this very complex picture together under emergency circumstances where often the time is not available or doesn't feel like it's available to do a lot of pre-testing. And Derek talked to us about the case of Swaziland where a bold program was put in place that was pulled because it was very controversial, but then again the controversy wasn't such a bad thing either. I think we have to ask ourselves, we live in a very diverse world. We've been talking about Southern Africa, where the levels of HIV prevalence are extremely high and where infections are leveling off at a very high level or increasing. We're also in a world where many countries are facing HIV epidemics that are concentrated in vulnerable populations that are often marginalized from the public policy debate and from the and where resources are not invested in prevention for them. And we're dealing with a world where many countries have epidemics that are generalized but at a low level of 1 to 2 and 3%. And do we not need a social revolution in the countries that have low-level epidemics, or do we? And if so, how do we support policymakers who are trying to focus the attention of the Ministry of Finance and the international community on preventing a situation of national devastation while the epidemics are still at a low level? Don't we need a social revolution? And I think, as Kent has pointed out, if women's rights are human rights, do we really want to live with a harm reduction approach that says let's give women tools to save their lives while their human rights are, because their human rights are going to be violated? Or do we want to move towards a world where people can control their own bodies and their own and their sexualities and make choices of their own? And last but not least, I just want to ask the question about resources. If you think about the kinds of data that have been presented today, and the time and effort that it's taken to develop these rich, in-depth analyses from the quantitative and the qualitative standpoint, are we really approaching the scaling up of behavior change interventions in the right way? Are we really investing enough in understanding the local circumstances and how these different pieces of the puzzle fit together in order to make sure that our resulting programs succeed the way Soul City has succeeded, because they do resonate and do have enormous meaning for the population, instead of succeeding the way the Swaziland programs succeeded, which was by causing such a flap in controversy that it got the dialogue going? Are we investing enough, and are we using the right kind of a model for scale-up for behavior change interventions?
Thank you.